Before we get going, here's the bit where I remind you that nothing we discuss during the endgame should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So, while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets. And now, on with the show.
Welcome, everybody. We are back. Welcome back to The Endgame. Joining me once again after our hiatus over the holidays is the other half of this not-so-dynamic duo, the Statler to my Waldorf, Bill Fleckenstein. Hi, mate. How are you?
Mate, it's good to see you. Where are you calling in from?
I am currently in sunny Australia, which I will go on the record of saying, certainly in Sydney, New South Wales at least, is nowhere near the police state that it's been painted as by social media around the world. So it's,
that's quite delightful here. That's a relief.
You're in the desert now, right?
I am in the desert trying to, stay away from the rain in Seattle until spring.
How's the tennis coming on? How's the reconstruction?
You mean of my Achilles?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, it's went brilliantly. The hard part is to rebuild the calf muscle. That's quite a chore, but I'm doing just fine. Thank you. Thank you for asking.
Good man. We're back. And to kick things off in this kind of second phase of the endgame, we have a returning guest with us, our mutual friend and a guy who blew a lot of people's minds when he joined us back in the first season of the endgame, episode 3, I think it was, and that's Mike Green, who is now at Simplify Asset Management, Bill. I mean, this is someone that you and I both love talking to and also both leave every conversation with him scratching their heads, going to research books and looking up all kinds of things that we hadn't even thought about.
Yeah, how can one guy know so much about so many different things?
Kind of scary, right?
Yeah,
kind exactly. of scary. Well, listen, I think that the most sensible thing to do is avoid you and I cluttering up people's heads with RNA nonsense and get the man himself on. What do you think?
Let's do it.
Here's Mike Green. Mike, welcome back to the Endgame, mate. It's always a pleasure to see you, though we can see less of you now than we could last time.
Yeah, well, fortunately, this is an audio-only podcast, so people don't have to see the fact that I still could lose some more weight, but thank you very much, Grant. I appreciate it.
It's been a hell of a year since we last spoke. We're just under a year, I think, since we last did this.
Nope.
And it was two years.
Yeah, it's almost two.
It was July 2020, not July 2021. Jeez.
Yeah.
Well, listen, so much has happened since then. And some of the work that you kind of first outlined on that podcast has gone on to become, some truly extraordinary contributions to people's understandings of what's happening now. And I think the world owes you a debt of thanks for that. But one of the things I want to kick off with, Mike, is we talked about the dynamics with passive. We've seen continued enormous inflows into the passive world. And yet we're now seeing a weaker market, a market that feels like it wants to go down. Just give us an update on the flows and why the dynamic seems to have changed, certainly for the time being in the overall broader market.
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of things that are always really important for people to understand about this, right? One is that the flows into passive have been extraordinary and they continue to be extraordinary. Last year in 2021, we brought in roughly $1 trillion worth of net inflows into US equities. That occurred despite the fact that there was about $300 billion of outflows from active managers, right? So by definition, we had to have basically $1.3 trillion come into passive vehicles. My analysis continues to be that that type of dynamic is largely responsible for the overall upward drift that we're seeing. But there is a second dynamic, and this is one of the things that you heard me talk about in, our earlier discussion, which is the market still relies very heavily on the behavior of active managers, right? Discretionary managers. And so I think that there's two things that are ultimately going on here. One is last year, you started to see the outflows from the Cathie Woods, et cetera, right? So this is the exception to the passive story. Individuals like Cathie Wood began to attract significant inflows into vehicles like ARK. In turn, they allocated capital into what I would consider to be relatively illiquid names and basically projected them upwards, reinforced by this passive dynamic, right? Because if Cathie Wood aggressively buys DocuSign, and then in turn, DocuSign is being purchased by a index fund with the price being set by whatever Cathie Wood had last set it at, it becomes a positive feedback loop that can propel things to extraordinary degrees. And then once Cathie began to receive outflows, right, or what was forced to deal with outflows, you can almost time it to the day that she first started seeing outflows, that the underperformance of that type of stock began to emerge. And there's been a number of people on Twitter and elsewhere who have done the overlay of ARK's flows relative to the behavior of some of the more speculative asset aspects, particularly the unprofitable, you know, kind of future vision tech sort of stuff. You know, when the active money starts coming out, ironically, that same process works in reverse. And I think that's a big chunk of what we saw, what we've seen on a year-to-date basis, right? This was kind of kicked off in the underlying dynamic. And again, I talked about this on Twitter and in other communications going into the end of the year, that December sell-off largely stayed away from the winners of 2021, right? So the Microsofts, Apples, et cetera, the world were relatively protected. And then we came into the start of the new year and suddenly people started taking profits because they could actually delay the tax payment for another year, right? The resistance to taking that tax hit was really, really high. And now we've seen, you know, the active manager space, the hedge fund space, the mutual fund space, et cetera, has rotated fairly quickly from an overweight position in technology to an underweight position in technology, right? They're basically trying to make an argument that this is all about reflation, that the oil markets, the energy markets are zooming upwards, and so they should reposition for that. And of course, this is part of the point that I keep making, that process of repositioning is driving the behavior that we see, right? Now, once that's done, and I think this is actually part of what's happening again, well, once that's done, then the forces of passive reassert themselves, right? And so broadly, we're seeing quality outperform again. We're seeing lower volatility names outperform again. We're seeing the Apples, Microsofts, et cetera, the world look relatively bid versus some of the other stuff that's out there. And it's just, it's hard for me to see this changing in any meaningful fashion as long as the primary contributions are coming in from 401ks that are allocating to the Vanguard Total Market Index or an S&P 500 or anything along those lines, right? I mean, that's where the cash is coming. And the repositioning of the risk takers, the active managers, is basically dressing on the salad, right? It, you know, adds a lot of flavor and spice to it, but it's not really the meal, right?
So when you said once this is done, what you were referring to is this current bit of rotation that the active managers have done in enough size to create the motion that we sort of see that is away from the passive stuff.
That's what I see happening. I think, you know, and I've commented on this elsewhere, but particularly on Twitter, you know, but the underlying dynamic is once they've sold Facebook, once they've sold Apple, once they've sold Microsoft, well, what do they do next? Right? Like if they decide to short them, right, which is challenging in this market, and more people are choosing not to short unless it's the Cathie Wood type stuff. And that runs a very real risk of getting crowded as well. Like things don't go down forever. And so it's, you know, it's just interesting to watch this dynamic where people gain this extraordinary confidence that, oh, well, now it's easy, right? This time it got easy. It's never easy. Like this is just not going to be easy. Right? That's not the way the game is played.
Mike, let me ask you, thinking about this, if the active manager rebalances are the kind of tail wagging the dog for the time being, obviously the places they're putting money into start going up, that potentially attracts a whole load of new momentum money to them. And these, you know, the oil and gas sector, the precious metal sector, commodity sector, these are much smaller than the technology sector in relative terms over the last years. Is it possible that we get a kind of, I don't know how to put this correctly, but you get kind of a more value-oriented approach driving passive flows into those names and away from momentum names, which kind of, I know it's circular logic, it kind of defeats the object, but is that possible?
So it's certainly that, I think that's exactly what we saw, right? And we saw the exact same thing happen around the November 2016 election, right? Anytime the narrative changes, you see the active management space suddenly approach the world with conviction, right? Instead of being confused, like, okay, we get it this time. This is what's going to happen, right? That process momentarily changes the market. But the minute that they are fully positioned, two things happen. One is the weakest players in that game are getting fired, right? It's just the simple math of the fact that their clients are older and the overall performance is one that is quite difficult to maintain, right? Those who have seen my presentations understand that there's actually a mechanical process that's underway that leads to negative alpha across the active management space in aggregate. And so once you're positioned and then you start getting fired, well, guess what? The stuff that you like gets sold. The stuff that you hated, that you're short, gets bought. And the process begins to fall apart, where everybody who had joined you in that trade is now trapped and basically facing the same underlying dynamics, right? So I could be wrong on this, but I just don't see the mechanism that allows that sustained reversal unless people suddenly start deciding, hey, I'm going to chase into active management. And that's so hard. I mean, I will tell you candidly, at Simplify, you know, we're a startup, we're a smaller firm, you know, we've grown incredibly fast and I'm really thrilled with that. But, you know, we're give or take a, you know, we're a small firm. We have a 401k plan, right? Our 401k plan at Simplify requires me to have 10% allocated of my 401k to a target date fund. Even if I choose to self-direct, I still have to put money into a target date fund.
So that you hinted at this either on our podcast or other ones you've done, or you've stated it. So the Vanguards and the BlackRocks have gotten enough leverage now in the lawmaking circles that they've actually gotten it so that you have no choice but to allocate 10% to one of those target date plans.
In our 401k, which is part of a multi-employer plan, which is one of the things we should talk about, but yes, like, and it's just not worth fighting, right? In a lot of ways. I'm doing everything I can to introduce products that allow people to have choices, that create, you know, that identify some of the risk factors that I've highlighted. And I'm active in terms of trying to change the regulatory regime. But let's just be really straightforward, right? Mike Green can speak as eloquently as possible. And at the end of the day, a regulator is going to say, well, that's really nice. And then call Vanguard or BlackRock, Larry Fink, and say, you know, they're not even going to get to Larry Fink, right? You know, but they're going to call the giants in the industry and they're going to say, oh, that's nonsense. And nobody's going to do anything, right? We just, there's nothing that can be done at this stage.
Until something bad happens down the road.
Something so bad happens that we're forced to say, well, we can't do that again.
Well, I want to ask you one question that I'm sure every stock picker would ask if they could talk to you. And that is, you make such a compelling case that it's almost like if you're trying to pick stocks, it almost like it seems futile to try because of the hurdles you got to get over. I mean, you know, between active managers losing assets and do you really think that it's completely futile?
I know. I hope it's not.
Okay.
But nothing I've seen in the past 2 years since we spoke last, you know, 18 months since we spoke last, has led me to conclude that it is becoming any easier or more relevant to try to play the very hard game of picking the right stocks, right? Because every part of the system is set up against you. And Cathie Wood is a great example, right? I mean, I've shared an analysis on Cathie Wood where I look at the performance of her fund, and effectively she was a 1.5 beta to the Qs and the NASDAQ 100 as her initial style. And then she began to attract assets, which meant that as you know, money flowed into ARK, which led to dramatic outperformance for ARK, which led to significantly more inflows. And to her credit, she was one of the first, if not the first, to offer an actively managed ETF product, right? So it combined lots of good components. Yeah. She also, I believe it's with Nikko Securities, has a distribution arrangement where, you know, she's distributed broadly on an international basis. And so a fairly significant quantity of her flows are coming in from global. Like that's a really impressive accomplishment from a business standpoint, right? It attracted flows. There had to be that one that was willing to run a 1.5 beta to the NASDAQ. She was that one, right? And so she attracted the flows, the money came in, and it behaved in that manner. But the entire time, if you actually disaggregate the sources of returns between her inflows and the behavior of the market, and then her stock picking on top of it, like she was negative alpha the whole way, right? There was literally like one quarter where Tesla had its inclusion in the S&P 500, where her fund shows positive alpha on my analysis. But the rest of it was just all you know, excess leverage and the self-recursive nature of the flows. Taking nothing away from the business, right? I mean, what an extraordinary accomplishment. That's unfortunately, I think, the way the game plays out. So you can be that lucky one. You can be the one who happens to get the sizing right. You can be the one who happens to be bearish if the markets crash or whatever. But you're still inevitably picking up pennies in front of a steamroller, and one misstep means the flows are going to come out. And that's what we're seeing with Cathy right now.
Mike, you mentioned Simplify there. Obviously, the last time we spoke, or since then and now, you have moved to Simplify, and you guys, as you say, are growing really fast. Now, I know you've taken some heat about kind of poacher turned gamekeeper and all that kind of stuff. So talk a little bit about that decision and what it is you guys are trying to do at Simplify.
Yeah, so I think one of the things that is really hard, right, is to remember that we're all playing a game. We don't get to make the rules of the game, right? Mm-hmm. Part of what I was articulating when we spoke last is it is largely futile to try to beat the S&P 500. The only thing you can do is take advantage of characteristics in the market that give you what I describe as non-recourse leverage to outperform it. Effectively grab a beta greater than one when you have that opportunity. Or two, if you are more concerned about the downside, which almost by definition, all wealthier people are, and asset management firms build products for wealthier people for the same reason that Bonnie and Clyde robbed banks, right?
Right.
I think it was Clyde Barrow actually said, you know, that's where the money is, right? But that is the way the game is played. And the rules of the game basically require me to mimic those exposures with overlays that we've constructed. And so that's what we've really tried to do at Simplify, is to introduce products that have the exposures of the indices that are attracting the most capital, whether that's the United States in terms of large cap exposures, or that's the Qs, or that's emerging markets, or we just introduced our first credit products, which mimic things like high yield or the Lehman Bond Aggregate, the old Lehman Bond Aggregate, now the Bloomberg Bond Aggregate, because they own everything. So those products are designed to offer those traditional exposures with the most thoughtful hedging that I can create around them, right? Providing the seatbelt in that car that's driving uphill with no brakes, right? Or, you know, if you're younger, and this is one of the perverse dynamics, right? If you're younger, because the products have been built for old people, you know, we're very actively trying to rethink how to structure retirement programs like target date funds, taking advantage of the regulatory framework to introduce products that are more appropriate for the younger generation, right?
Let me ask you a question there, Mike, if I could.
Sure.
If you're a younger person in a target date fund, as long as passive is winning, then you're doing fine being in that target date fund. The ultimate moment in time will be when something bad happens as a function of passive. So, not saying exactly the exact product you designed, what flaw are you trying to fix if passive is working now until it doesn't? What do you do to say to capture that and then fix whatever you see as a problem, if you understand my question?
Yeah, no, I do. And so the irony about that is that's the perception that everybody has, right? Because a target date fund typically for a younger person is going to allocate something like 95% to US equities and 5% to bonds, right? The irony is actually that investment allocation is fantastically under-risked for that young person. Now, nobody else can see this, but Bill is looking at me with this incredibly quizzical expression. Think about the actual variance of that portfolio, not of the underlying asset. You start at the age of 20, let's just make our lives simple. Say you're 22 years old, you've graduated from college, you get your first new job, you get a brand spanking new set of business casual attire, you sit down at your desk, they give you a computer, and you get signed up for your 401k with your target date fund by the HR manager who has selected this from a menu of choices available to you that they received at lowest cost from Vanguard, right? Totally standard at this point. When I look at that portfolio and I think about the starting value of that portfolio and the ending value of that portfolio based on your first year of employment, right? Starting value is zero. Let's say you make a contribution of $400 every 2 weeks. That's too aggressive. $200 every 2 weeks into that portfolio, right? So you have 26 contributions of $200 each in your first year. What's the actual variance of that portfolio, starting balance to ending balance, that's determined by the stock market? Zero. None of that variability is driven by the stock market. The variability is determined by, did you contribute? Did your employer match? Right? And did you get fired? Right? Like, those are the only variables that actually have any meaningful impact, because you're starting at that 200 that you start with. Sure, fine. Let's say it has a 16% gain. It doesn't mean anything relative to all the other contribution that's going on. And this is part of the great irony of what's happening to young people today, is that they're starting off so far behind the curve, where they are, you know, buried in student loan debt that they're trying to build themselves out of, that keeps them from making contributions that appreciate. But that pay down of that student loan debt is significantly affecting their net worth calculation, right? Assuming that they're able to make those payments. Their contribution to their 401k is largely just savings. Like, you could basically stick it into a cash account and have almost the exact same outcome when you come through it. What the younger generation doesn't have access to, perversely, are the levered assets that we took advantage of. 10 to 20% down on a house when we're 26 years old, right? Or the opportunity to be in jobs as a young college educated person, where we're very rapidly promoted because we're in growing industries with a shortage of college educated individuals that create the opportunities for radical change in our lives. That's where the screw up is occurring, right? We're not giving them the opportunity to do what they should be doing at that stage in their life, which is to play lottery ticket like outcomes, where the simple reality is that you want them to be taking much more risk early on with their investments, right? And this is part of the reason why, like, we all sit there and we look at what they're doing with crypto and we try to understand it in this dynamic of YOLO, right? Well, that makes perfect sense, right? Because it is a tiny fraction of their overall asset mix once you properly factor in the human capital and a lifetime of working and earning ahead of them. And they're begging us for something that offers them appropriate volatility in terms of their allocation, similar to the volatility of the equity in a home. When you put 10% down, right? Like, that equity, you know, vacillates wildly and has the potential for massive appreciation because of the leverage. They don't have access to those products because of how we've structured our society today. And if anything, they're starting so far behind the curve with their student loans that, again, there's no... They desperately want that lottery type dynamic, and we need to give it to them in a more prudent fashion, not tell them just shut up, sit down, you know, put your nose to the grindstone and work for the next 40 years. And if you're lucky, maybe you'll get a gold watch. They saw that movie. They don't believe in it.
Mike, you know, it's interesting. You mentioned the B word there. So we have to kind of take a brief detour down that road. One of the products that you guys offer is a Bitcoin fund. Right now, I saw it was obvious what was going to happen as soon as you announced that. It was obvious what was going to happen. And of course, it did happen exactly as predicted. But talk a little bit about that, and talk a little about what it's designed to do. And I am interested genuinely in the feedback. And now it's settled down, how that's gone.
So the product that you're referring to, SPBC, is a U.S. equity plus Bitcoin allocation. Right. And it was an outgrowth. And this is, again, part of the reason why I do podcasts like this and I do the Bitcoin debates, et cetera, because they expose me to thinking that, you know, kind of forces me to say, well, wait a second, is there an opportunity there as a business standpoint, right? So I did a debate, and I'm being as generous as I possibly can in terms of describing it that way, with Anthony Pompliano, right? This was on Real Vision, a firm I know you've heard of. And the question was asked, you know, Mike, what is wrong with a 1% allocation to Bitcoin? And my response to that was somewhat flippant. It's like, well, you could lose that 1%, but that sat very uncomfortably with me for a very valid reason, right? There's nothing wrong with a 1% allocation to Bitcoin. The issue is there's no way to do it. Right. And so if you think about somebody who goes out and buys a 1% allocation to Bitcoin, let's say Bitcoin is fantastically successful and it triples or quadruples or quintuples over the course of a year. Well, now you've got a 5% allocation to Bitcoin. And with Bitcoin at the time, at least realizing, you know, 100% volatility, that consumes all of the vol that is available in your budget and basically says, okay, you should own Bitcoin and US treasuries, right? Like that's, like this is a terrible portfolio allocation. It has some interesting characteristics to it, but it's an overall terrible portfolio allocation. The second issue that you have is the target market for Simplify is an area that we're actually quite thrilled to see doing better than I think many had expected, which is the RIA, the Registered Investment Advisor space. And you know, you say this in your intro to the Endgame, you know, always seek professional advice in dealing with these crazy markets. More and more, we're seeing people need to use very thoughtful robo-advisor platforms or individuals that help them to customize and think about what they should be doing. Within that RIA space, the problems that I just articulated with volatility and allocation are magnified even larger, right? Because if you're an RIA and you have 100 clients and you're trying to manage each of those individual portfolios, if they come to you and say, hey, I want a 5% allocation to Bitcoin, now you have a portfolio that is wildly inappropriate in terms of its volatility. And the second issue that you're dealing with as an RIA is, well, that's great, but how the hell do I do this? How do I custody this? How do I, you know, et cetera? Now, that's what a lot of the innovation in Bitcoin has actually been focused on, right? Like, okay, here's an approved custody arrangement. So you can buy this thing, you know, et cetera. And it's largely been focused on how do I get speculators into the system rather than how do I actually use this, as we're seeing with the Canadian truckers, for example. But what we did was took it a step further. And we basically said, look, if you want to have a 1% allocation, here's what we're going to do. We're going to combine a 10% allocation or a 100% allocation with US equities, and then use a touch of leverage so that you get an additional 10% into Bitcoin. So if you put 10% into SPBC, you have 10% US equities and 1% Bitcoin, right? And then we do a second thing, which is rebalance. And this is the last critical component that we benefit from in terms of SPBC, is because we're rebalancing inside an ETF, it has none of the tax ramifications that would happen if you were rebalancing outside. And so it was a really interesting opportunity to do something that there was clearly need for, clearly demand for. The product's about $125 million in AUM. It's actually probably more than that today in terms of AUM. So we've actually become one of the larger Bitcoin-oriented funds in relatively short order. But it only carries a fraction of that in Bitcoin, and it's the overall exposure that is useful for an RIA who has a client who says, hey, I really want to have exposure to this, right? And it allows them to do so in a tax-efficient, managed way so that their Bitcoin exposure or anything else, if it's wildly successful, they get some excess performance. If it's terrible, you know, it doesn't end up killing them. And most importantly, it makes the job easier for people.
Just out of curiosity, how often do you rebalance that thing?
So we rebalance it based on appreciation. So if the Bitcoin allocation falls below 5%, we'll top it back up. And if the Bitcoin allocation rises above 15%, we'll sell it. Now, that was one of the fortunate outcomes for the product, was when Bitcoin shot to, I guess it was 65,000 or something, we actually had the opportunity to sell some, take that money off the table, redeploy it into US equities. And so, you know, the performance of that fund has actually done quite a bit better than just a pure allocation, you know, in the same format to Bitcoin. The second thing is, and this is, you know, there are legitimate complaints from the Bitcoin community about access. So we use the Grayscale Bitcoin Trust, which is expensive and currently trades like a closed-end fund at a significant discount to the underlying Bitcoin. One of the things I love is that we're able to take advantage of that and effectively give extra exposure. And so if Grayscale is able to convert to an ETF, you'll see that discount close. That'll represent a windfall opportunity for that fund as well. So we've tried to be really thoughtful about it. We've tried to recognize that it's not at all possible for me to know all of the answers on this stuff. And more importantly, we're doing what we set out to do, which is make it possible for registered investment advisors to run a business without killing themselves in terms of you know, how do I actually offer clients this exposure they want in a responsible framework. And you know, it's funny, if you go on my Medium post, you can find it through my Twitter profile, which, as I think most people know, is ProfPlum99. you know, if you go to my Medium, you'll actually see that I wrote an article saying, do not buy this ETF, right? You know, but it does fill an important role in the portfolios of somebody who's trying to give access to crypto. And ultimately, I just want to emphasize this, as the SEC lifts restrictions on things like crypto and removes some of the barriers that prevent people from accessing these, we're positioned to offer diversified exposure, right? So I have no love lost for Bitcoin, is very clear at this point, but I really do think that what's going on in the crypto space in terms of the introduction of digitally native securities is really important. And so I you know, this really helps me actually to make sure that I have a vested interest in maintaining and increasing my knowledge in the space.
Mike, I started to keep track at first, but I've kind of lost track. How many different products do you have there now? It seems, I mean, I don't know how much we can talk about each one, but it seems to me from what I was paying attention to at first, you have some really interesting niches that you've been able to fill. And I was curious, and for people that are listening might want to know, how do they get up to speed on the different ways you've thought to be able to skin the cat?
Yeah. So we have two separate businesses. One, we have an active ETF component, the Volt funds. That's not something I'm actively involved in, but we have a talented, you know, group of individuals that are focused on kind of what I would describe as the Cathie Wood-like innovations, you know, without Cathie Wood.
Right.
You know, that is an area that I think is important. And I think broadly speaking, that active ETFs are going to be an area of growth as we move forward. My product focus is primarily around these traditional exposures, the S&P 500, emerging markets, the Russell 2000, et cetera. And then providing option overlays that either enhance upside participation. So we have products like SPYC or SPUC that use call options to gain access to non-recourse leverage. But the vast majority of the products that we have are focused in one way or another on providing a degree of insurance, right? So we have, and we've basically brought the hedge fund type approach where we've negotiated ISDA agreements with major banks that allow us to do things like some of our most, you know, innovative work, I would argue, are in products like PFIX.
Right. Yeah.
That is a interest rate swaption, right? It is an option on the level of interest rates, not on the price of a bond, which has negative convexity to it, but to the interest rate themselves, so that it is a positively convex product that can be embedded within a portfolio and with a small allocation provides protection against that portfolio. Mm-hmm. Same thing on recently introduced products in the credit space, CDX and AGGH, where we're offering a credit hedge or a rate hedge component to remove some of the risks associated with those areas. And we've worked really hard to try to do some innovative stuff, taking advantage of either work I've done over the last decade or work that Harley Bassman, my partner at Simplify, has done in terms of interest rates or various other things. So, you know, to answer your question directly, we're actually now up to 21 ETFs.
Wow.
We've been very busy as you know, the team that we've assembled, which largely came out of PIMCO, but with a lot of other talented individuals. We've just been, I've been so pleased with the way that we've executed to this point.
Wow. Well, I intended when you first started rolling them out, I got involved with the PFIX at first, personal full disclosure. And I thought, well, I'm going to stay on top of all these products. And you started releasing them so fast and I got distracted with other things. I decided,
good for you.
I couldn't stay on top of it all.
Well, that unfortunately is part of the reality of this business, right? I mean, you can have a flagship product like an ARK, for example, that effectively becomes a one size fits all in speculation. But what we're really trying to do is construct the tools that allow a registered investment advisor to offer a portfolio that has very different characteristics in aggregate, right? And so the core of a portfolio, an S&P type exposure, that's been a fantastic investment for the past decade, right? And it's been very hard for the active manager to keep up. But you can enhance the return profile around that either using call options in for non-recourse leverage or with downside protection to mitigate the drawdowns in periods like March 2020. We just went through a period where we mitigated the drawdown, and today we're mitigating drawdown, right? So we're seeing the portfolio do what we want it to do. We had the equity component. We have, you know, PFIX introduces a rate component, which is obviously an area of concern for people with inflation being high. That for me is less of a concern. As you guys know, I fall in the camp that says that rates don't necessarily follow inflation, particularly in periods of financial repression. But you know, we've now started to round that out with access to emerging markets, access to credit products, et cetera, that give RIAs the tools that they can start to construct portfolios that are truly differentiated. And the next step for us is going to be taking those same exposures and building the next generation of target date funds, for example, right? Because it's not, the problem is not that people are investing, right? That's a good thing, right? We want people to invest, but what we don't want people to do is all do the same thing, right? Like that's just not healthy. There's not a robustness to the ecosystem that makes it work long-term.
Well, let's examine the downside of passive and how it may end, and a guess as to how long that might take, perhaps. As I say, in the last couple of years, a lot of people now understand this, but you must have some view on that and what the warning signs might be, if any, if we're going to get to that moment in time.
Well, I think the warning signs are unfortunately very clear, right? I mean, we're still sitting within a few percentage points of all-time highs, and I'm getting reports back from my sell-side coverage that liquidity has vanished, right? Yeah. That the front of book liquidity that you guys have heard me talk about before is just gone, right? And this is a natural byproduct of volatility being increased and the structure of a market that requires market makers to facilitate in a high frequency framework as compared to the transparency of an order book. I'm not suggesting, by the way, people have heard me talk about this. They're like, you know, well, you just want to go back to Spearley's and Kellogg and et cetera, et cetera. That's not what I'm suggesting at all, but there are distinct costs associated with a model in which market makers have the right, but not the obligation to provide liquidity, right? And when we're seeing that as volatility increases, the way those systems work, those high frequency attempts to mimic an order book, they're an outgrowth of the work that Dwayne Farmer did in the 1990s, a guy who's got an IQ 10 times higher than mine, by the way. If anyone doesn't know the story of Dwayne Farmer, spelled D-O-Y-N-E, and the Prediction Company, which was his first fund that averaged 450% a year in the 1990s. Just insane. I mean, wow. Truly, truly insane. What Dwayne figured out was that he could use his skills as a nuclear physicist to simulate the atomic decay of orders in an order book, right? Effectively taking the principle of atomic half-life and applying that to the behavior of orders placed into an order book to build a stochastic model of the order book that actually allowed him to front run the existing specialists, right? Think how crazy that is in your brain. Right?
You said it's already happened. And when I hear you say that, I'd say there's no chance that could ever work.
But, yeah, but it seems so much easier to just put a box really close to the server.
but that is part of it, right? But those insights actually sit at the core of the market making operations as they exist today, right? And so what is happening in the market making operations, and this is where you hear the spoofing and all that sort of stuff, right? You're effectively sending out, you know, the equivalent of noise pulses, right? You know, the echolocation of a dolphin, where the information that gets bounced back to you provides you with a map of what that order book looks like, where the liquidity is, where the bids and the asks are, et cetera, right? When volatility picks up, it's like introducing mud or silt into the water, right? The dolphins effectively become blind and they want to get out of there because that represents risk to them. They have to slow down their swimming speeds and everything else, right? That's what's happening. Volatility is higher. The waters are a little bit more cloudy. The market makers are less comfortable putting true risk up. And so liquidity vanishes. And it's a feedback loop that is largely playing out right before our eyes. The more fundamental question in terms of the flows and the money going into passive, right? There's just no sign that that has stopped. And part of the irony is I mentioned before, the multi-employer plan for Simplify in terms of our 401k There were a number of innovations that kicked in at the start of 2021 that facilitated these huge inflows that we're seeing. In particular, the introduction of multi-employer plans expanded the universe of 401ks. So traditionally, if you were a small business person, you would not have offered a 401k to your employees. The Trump Tax Act, I think it's TJCA, the Tax Justice, whatever it was, of 2017 introduced the equivalent of multi-employer plans in 401ks in the same way that they exist within healthcare, right? And so now suddenly, if you're a small business, you can successfully offer a 401k. There's an additional product that was introduced. I believe it's called a single beneficiary defined benefit plan, right? And the single beneficiary defined benefit plan allows small business persons to, instead of saving the $16,000 or I guess it's $19,000 now that you can for your 401k with the $7,000 in your IRA, with an SPDC, SBDC, you can save up to $500,000 tax-free on an annual basis. And the money that flowed into small businesses through things like PPP loans exploded that market. And we've now seen a culture where businesses are effectively stripping out the working capital that they have in their businesses to stick it tax-free into an SBDC in basically unheard of sums. And all of that money is going passive, right? So it's just, we keep changing the rules. We keep changing, you know, the dynamics around what are the products that are allowing people to put money to work. They increasingly favor the high end as well as, you know, the entry level. The choices that are available, people are more and more comfortable with the idea that if I just put the money into the S&P 500, it's going to be fine. You know, whether that's true long-term or not is hard to know. The last thing, and I think we had talked about this in July of 2020, because this data was already out, right? People forget that when you put money into a 401k, by and large, people don't even know that that's there. They don't change their selections. They don't actively manage it. If anything, they look at it once a year and say, oh, wow, that's a lot of money. Right. And then kind of forget about it. Right. We've seen a dramatic decrease since we changed the rules in 2006 so that it became you had to opt out rather than opt in. And a selection was made for you that was non-cash. Right. It was called the qualified default investment alternative, where now 85% of each incremental dollar going into 401ks is going in through a target date fund. You just don't see people critically examine this stuff. They don't do anything. And so those assets that are sitting there, Vanguard made a point of expressing pride in how well-disciplined their investors were. In March 2020, less than 1% of Vanguard's client base transacted in an unusual manner.
Yeah.
And now that is a point of pride for Vanguard, and hats off to their clients who stuck with it and benefited from the recovery that occurred afterwards. But my God, what if it had been two, right? Or five? Or what does the world look like when we see the retirements, right? And somebody actually had pointed this out the other day. I think I've shared the anecdote that if you go and you look at August of 2015, you actually see a very clear example of the sort of impact that can occur. Late August 2015, most people associate that very sharp correction in the S&P and the chaos that occurred in ETFs and other spaces as associated with the China devaluation, right? Well, that China devaluation happened 5 days before. There's no evidence it had any meaningful impact on the S&P 500. But what did happen was there was a restructuring of the profile of Vanguard's target date funds that led them to sell US equities. And suddenly everybody walked in on August 24th as Vanguard is in this sell program and ETFs are dysfunctional, right? You can't, the market's not opening, all sorts of chaos is going around. We have real world examples that show when that occurs. I just think we haven't diagnosed them properly.
Mike, let's shift a little bit because the subject of inflation has come up a couple of times in what we've talked about so far. And obviously, there's a very different broad dynamic around us today than there was back when we spoke in July of 2020. Yeah. The inflation, you guys, you and Harvey hosted a fantastic discussion with Lacey Hunt recently about this exact topic. And if anyone listening hasn't heard that, I presume it's on the Simplify website, but
it is on the Simplify website.
It's just tremendous. So let's just get your views on inflation as it pertains to all the things we've talked about, whether it is a meaningful spanner in the works, and if so, the damage it could potentially do if this continues.
So my views on inflation, unfortunately, fall into the camp that calls it transitory, right?
And
it feels like it's hard to know how much of it is willful ignorance and how much of it is just a genuine failure on my part and others' part to explain what we meant by transitory, right? By transitory, first, I'm referring to the inflation rate, not the price level. So we have seen a meaningful change in supply chains and structures, and the dynamics of sticky prices and everything else mean that it's highly likely that many of the products that we deal with will have different price levels going forward. We're not going to see negative $37 in oil anytime soon again. It's kind of one of the easiest ways to think about that. But the transitory inflation rate is what people were referring to, where we basically have this one-off pulse that is the mirror image magnified to a certain extent of the negative deflationary pulse that occurred in March, April, May of 2020, right? At the time when I was a logic guy, I wrote a paper that compared what happened with the pandemic to a unexpected shutdown in a seasonal town, right? So a Cape Cod, you know, tourist resort, they shut down in October. They don't reopen until April. And this is the exact same thing that basically happened with the pandemic. We declared war on the pandemic and we decided to shut down the global economy. What's happening now are, by and large, what I would refer to as the, you know, frictions that you experience when you wake up from a long nap, right? You know, as you get older, you wake up after going to bed the night before, and yes, you're rested, but you're stiff and your joints, you know, you need to stretch and you need to take all the precautions to do that, right? That's what is happening right now, right? The frictions associated with turning back on a global supply chain, particularly for things like semiconductors, are the same things that we've seen for toilet paper and various other stuff, where the patterns of consumption shifted very radically, right? Autos are a great example, right? And I actually shared this example in the discussion with Lacey Hunt. I would encourage people to go to the Simplify website, register, and watch that presentation. So one of the things that I share in there is actually an analysis that looks at new car pricing. And the point is that we have give or take 300 million autos in the United States. Depreciation, accidents, and various other things mean that somewhere around 15 million of those are going to disappear in any given year, right? That means we need 15 million just to maintain, much less deal with the type of situation that we had in 2020 and 2021, where people moved out of cities into suburban regimes. They needed cars for transportation, et cetera. And simultaneously, we dropped the number of cars that we manufactured from give or take 16, 17 million to about 12 million, right? On a global basis, the decline was even larger. That meant that there was a deficit of cars available to fit that. And in a system in which the supply curve has shifted inward and you have a largely inelastic demand curve, particularly because it can take advantage of lower interest rates for financing purposes, demand is shifted outwards, prices are going to increase a lot. And I don't need to do anything from the Fed in terms of money printing or, you know, monetary inflation to fully explain the price behavior of new cars. Used cars are just a more inelastic version of that same analysis, right? You know, if I can't get access to a new car and new car dealers are going to be somewhat hesitant to jack up prices because they recognize the you know, penalty associated with that. Do you actually go to them for service, et cetera? The used car dealers, we tend to not think of them as, you know, very favorable. And there's a reason for that, because they're more than happy to screw you in the process, right? So with a shortage of used cars, used car prices rose 40%+. I don't need the Fed to describe what happened other than the minor component of lowering interest rates, and that facilitated the financing of those new cars, to a lesser extent, the used cars. That for me feels like the vast majority of the story that's in play, right? Now, is there a component, and I think this is going to be the bigger story, where governments react to the increase in prices and governments react to the shortage of fuel by choosing to subsidize those things, right? Are we going to see the introduction of rent subsidies? Are we going to see the introduction of fuel subsidies? We're already starting to hear very strong discussion around this with suspension of the gasoline tax, for example, in the United States. Those are all strategies designed to maintain demand in the face of a shortage of supply. That means that the developed world is going to rob those commodities and those supplies from the developing world that can't afford to do that. And I think that's the scariest thing that's actually underway, right? I put out a tweet earlier today saying, like, you think you have it bad in California or in New Jersey with rising oil prices, try being in Malawi, right? They're truly running out. And we're creating a humanitarian crisis tied to fertilizer, you know, et cetera, where the shortages of fertilizer that are being put into crops today mean that we're going to have fewer crops available to fit the global food supply character, global food supply needs. Again, from an American perspective or from a European, Western European perspective, that's really not that big of a deal because the food that we buy for the most part is so heavily processed, has so much value added content that we're talking about, you know, a box of Frosted Flakes rising by, you know, 50 cents or a dollar versus its price, which feels like an awful lot, but is really not that much on a percentage basis. On the flip side of it, you're talking about areas around the world, particularly in Africa, to a lesser extent in South America, that just literally are not going to have food. And this is the really terrifying component of what's underway right now. And it's going to take time for it to work through. It's going to take concerted effort and good decision-making process. And, you know, we talked in the Endgame episode 3 about, like, well, what is the actual game that's in play? Man, I'm still sitting here 2 years later saying, I'm not entirely sure, but what we have definitely seen is a cavalcade of terrible decision-making. And so my, you know, I am less hopeful than I was then that this is going to have a positive resolution.
I want to just touch for a second on a couple of things that you said there, because I don't want to turn this into a debate of, yep. Well, no, it's not going to be transitory, because I'd rather hear how you see things flow. But one of the things that I've been struck by is that example that you gave of cars was really a cogent analysis. If I take a step back, it seems to me that across every industry that we can think of, the idea of just in time and precision became overdone in much as the same way that if you have politicians, you know, that kick the can kicking led to a problem that was much bigger than if they'd have tried to solve it along the way. It seems to me we have a lot of car type stories layered on top of each other, the fine tuning of the supply chain, the fact that everyone thought that, you know, we can always get whatever we need, so we don't need to carry a little extra. Well, if we collectively need to carry a little extra, given the fine balance, it takes a while to catch up. And then there's the silly, well, some people don't think so, but this silly infatuation with ESG and what's that's done to hydrocarbons and then the natural gas, how it plays into ag. And anyway, when I stack all of these things up and then you layer in the decision-making that goes along the way, it seems to me that it's possible that the stickiness of these issues is liable to be with us longer than people think, even as year over year or month to month price fluctuations move all over the place. The overall level of prices might stay high for longer for these various reasons that I just kind of alluded to.
Oh, I, to be very clear, I actually agree that the level of prices has shifted and we are likely to see these prices maintain, but the level of inflation, which is the continuous change in the rate of prices, in my opinion, is likely to perhaps not reverse, but certainly revert back down to that very low level. And the primary reason is exactly what you articulated. What we are seeing is a deep questioning of the rationale and the integration of the Chinese supply chain and the US, the globalization framework, right? Now, one point that I would make is that we had already started the process of moving out of China. And this is something that China has had to struggle with as they passed what's referred to as their Louisian turning point, Arthur Lewis, growth economics. You moved past the point that the additions to China's labor force from people moving from the rural environment to the urban environment had created a continuous supply of increasingly higher productivity labor. The minute you pass that, their wages start to explode. We've seen that in China. And today, it's much less expensive in many situations to manufacture products for your local market in your local regime. Husqvarna, for example, a manufacturer of lawnmowers, motorcycles, et cetera, just reshored their low-cost motorcycle manufacturing to Europe because they can't do it anymore in China, particularly when you factor in the potential supply disruptions, the logistics challenges. I think we'll see more and more of that. And ironically, that will reassert the excess supply that we had, because the second factor, and this is what's so radically different from the 1970s, is you don't have the outward shift in aggregate demand associated with growth of populations, right? So what I continue to argue was the hidden factor behind the inflationary conditions of the 1960s and 1970s was the extraordinary growth in the U.S. in the global population, but in particular developed world population, and the level of economic participation, where suddenly women went from being part of a 2.2 or five-person household with, you know, three children and a husband, to increasingly establishing their own households, right? And needing their own dishwashers and needing their own apartments and homes, et cetera. So you have this fantastic outward shift in the aggregate demand function that happened in the 1960s and 1970s that it was almost impossible to catch up with because the population was growing so fast, right? In the United States, I think it peaked in 1979, the trailing five-year labor force growth was about 3.5% per year. I mean, that's a mind-blowing number when you actually think about it. Today, we're running at like 0.1% per year, right? Like, that's just think about how much easier it is to catch up.
I think that is well stated. The other area that I think can add an element of unpredictability to the environment we're in and trying to see our way to the end of it is, I think the psychological component is important in that in the 70s, people came to expect that prices would go up and they behaved in a similar fashion. And also, even though we had the big bulge in the labor, as you noted, you know, we had the collective bargaining agreements where the COLAs were getting ratcheted up. So even though we had more people, the cost of the labor force in a lot of industries was getting ratcheted up. So it seems to me that there's an interplay that can get involved there that is not so easily sort of teased apart in an equation. And if the log jams and the things that we're dealing with goes on longer, not to say that we keep having big price hikes, it seems to me that the psychology and things like that can change a little bit. And pardon me. And make it last longer. That's my hunch, is that this period of confusion, so to speak, is going to last longer than people think. Not that the amplitude is necessarily going to go, you know, crazy.
Yeah. So again, I agree with you that the process of resolving this is going to be more challenging than most people have expected. We're starting to see signs that it is reversing itself, but that psychology that you're highlighting, I do think it's important, but the way it manifests itself is if I expect prices are going to rise next year, it's not so much that a household decides, you know what, I'm going to buy two houses because the prices are going up, right? It's that they actually say, you know what, let's get a larger pack of toilet paper because prices are going up. Let's build up our pantry. That's a small fraction of what happened in the 1970s. The much more important component was businesses taking advantage of things like accounting changes where you introduce things like last in, first out. Right. So your highest cost product was what you actually expensed, right? That depressed your profit margins, but improved your cash flow significantly. And likewise, as they expected higher prices, they said, boy, we better stock up inventory from a business standpoint. And that made perfect sense because you had this extraordinary growth in the outward shift of the aggregate demand curve that meant that you were almost never going to get caught with too much excess supply. When that finally broke, right, in the early 1980s, it's what we call the Volcker recession. He ended up hiking interest rates in a manner that actually exacerbated the headline inflation numbers. This is very cogently written about by Alan Blinder in a 1982 paper called The Anatomy of Double-Digit Inflation in the United States. And he identified that Volcker himself, because of the construction of CPI, was largely responsible for the late stages of the inflation itself. Right, the way the Fed calculated inflation at the time referenced the mortgage payment that you would pay on your average house. That mortgage payment was directly tied to the Fed's policy rate. And so as the Fed hiked interest rates, it was causing the largest portion of the CPI weighting to actually rise as well, right? Sending all sorts of false signals. Now, people will argue that we're seeing similar dynamics around things like rent, et cetera. I largely believe that those arguments are poorly positioned, but they do create the mechanics of OER, owner's equivalent rent, does create a slow bleed where the data sets are only sampled every 6 months. That means we're going to have elevated levels of inflation, even as the experience of inflation is likely to retreat. The second component that I would say we're already seeing, and Danielle DiMartino Booth, a friend of all of ours, has probably been the foremost person emphasizing this, that we're seeing most of the growth in GDP at this point is actually a function of inventory builds, right? So it is businesses saying, I'm not sure I'm going to be able to get the supply, therefore I'm going to increase the size of my order and I'll store some of it as inventory. And I'm pretty certain that I can pass through the price increases because everybody's worried about inflation. So some of that inflationary mindset is creeping in, but those inventory levels are building, right? And we're creating the conditions under which that shortage is going to turn into surplus, particularly because there's not that same outward shift in aggregate demand that's coming from the population growth. And that was a key component of the discussion that Lacey and I had with Harley Bassman.
Mike, there's one place that kind of all this comes together, and that is wages. And I think this is kind of perhaps the most important component of this. And you had a fantastic chart in that conversation with Lacey. We are seeing pressure on wages, significant pressure on wages, and you can't open a newspaper or look at the internet every day without somebody jacking wage prices up or someone demanding a higher wage. But you had a phenomenal chart showing the difference in real wages in three periods, one being 2008, one being now, and was the other one, what was the third?
It was 2008 and today,
2008, right. You showed that real wages have fallen dramatically now. So that to me just means that the pressure to increase wages is going to continue and is going to elevate the more that goes down. How big a problem do you think wages are, and how does that dynamic reverse itself?
Well, so for me, this is a little bit like the arguments around debt, right? Because debt is somebody's asset, and I've never once heard people complain that the problem is there's too many assets, right? So I don't think there's a problem with wages. I actually would love to see wages rise. And
how big a problem is it that the constant demand for higher and higher wages? That's one part that's sticky.
So this is actually the point that I would make is that chart is telling you the exact opposite. That chart is telling you that everybody is listening to the headline saying, hey, there's wage pressures. But the reality of what's actually happening is that real wages are falling, which means consumption is shifting inward. Right, people don't have the capacity to pay their bills. They don't have the capacity to make the consumption that they want to. Now, that can show up as me protesting and saying, hey, I demand a wage raise. But the simple reality is that McDonald's is replacing low-wage workers with automated terminals and, you know, robotic cooking machines. You've got, like, this is all happening in real time. We are seeing a world shift where we place our orders when we go to the fast casual restaurant, and we do it over an iPad, or we do it, we place an order for takeout, right? So we're reducing the labor content as we speak and setting the conditions up for actual pressure on wages, which is what we're really actually seeing. The point of that chart is that the normal recovery mechanism from a recession is a decline in prices and an increase in purchasing power that makes people feel more confident and more capable of expending money to buy against the reduced production capacity that comes out of a recession. That's the normal recovery process. We short-circuited that this time because through a combination of monetary and fiscal policy that effectively pulled forward all the excess demand and created the conditions of the inflation that's now destroying purchasing power at the exact same time that the signal is coming through to say, hey, let's expand capacity. Right. So we're actually bizarrely setting ourselves up for the exact opposite of what I think most people think, which is a loss of purchasing power on the individual basis that doesn't get compensated.
Right, but the difference this time around to 2008 and 2000 is you do have significant headline inflation. You do have people being confronted with higher prices, and you do have a political environment where robots aren't going to complain they're not getting paid enough, right? But people are, and they can feel viscerally that they can't afford to buy the groceries they bought last week. I was talking to guys down here in Australia who are paying 3x the fertilizer input cost for their farm. And so at a moment in a political moment like we're at now, where like we saw in the 70s with Carter, people were complaining to their congressman about the cost of living, and it became a political means to beat inflation. Yep. I just feel that we may be at a point now where the demands for higher wages, misguided or not, are going to start coming through, and that becomes then a political problem, which kind of has to be dealt with.
So again, I just want to emphasize the demand for higher wages, I don't think is misguided at all, but let's take your example of the Australian farmer who's dealing with much higher fertilizer costs, right? So how does that farmer choose to handle that? There's two mechanisms that are available to them. One is they can say, screw it, I'm going to pay the higher prices for fertilizer, and I'm going to hope that the market accommodates my higher costs with higher prices in the future, right? The other is they say, you know what, I'm going to skimp on fertilizer this year. I'm going to deplete the retained fertilizer in the soil. I'm going to run the risk of a slightly lower harvest, right? But I've reduced my input costs, right? If that happens on a large scale basis, and there's variability around it tied to weather and all sorts of other stuff as well. But if that ends up happening, then we have less grain, right? That less grain means the price of bread goes higher. It means the price of beef goes higher. It means the price of all these sorts of things go higher. But nowhere in that process does that farmer get to demand a higher price. Likewise, labor does not get to demand a higher price. They can raise their voice politically. It can be perceived that the right answer coming from Congress or other rulemaking bodies around the world is to raise minimum wages or to increase subsidies, et cetera. But if that's happening in a regime in which aggregate demand is not rising significantly, then what you effectively are doing are creating the conditions under which the reaction function from business people is to say, you know what, minimum wage went up, I'm going to use less labor, right? And it ends up raising unemployment and creating conditions under which we actually we're much worse off. But I don't understand how that translates to the sustained inflation. It just means that you end up with a lower demand, lower supply component.
But we have a shortage of laborers now. I mean, so that it sort of ameliorates that argument to some degree. Obviously, the shortages are in different industries and things like that. I think what this also argues for is more confusion and consequences for longer, right? I don't know if Deere really had to give a 30. I can't remember what the pay raise that they gave. I want to say 30%, but it seems too high. I don't remember. But obviously, they felt that they had to do something to keep these people now. And it just seems like we could be in an environment longer where those kind of accidents happen on the upside for prices just because of all of these different problems that are all occurring at once.
Yeah. And so the point I would make is that Deere workers are unionized, right? So they were able to negotiate en masse. The demand because of higher farm prices for things like tractors, et cetera, is off the charts. And so Deere had to make the choice. Do we deal with a walkout that occurred, right? A strike that effectively shuts our production, or do we bend to the workers? And they made a choice to bend to the workers. Will that same thing happen with the New York City subway system, with teachers? We're already starting to see dynamics around this. Where you have unionization, yes, I think that's absolutely a factor. Are we going to see it for McDonald's franchise employees? Kind of skeptical.
Probably not. Right?
We're already seeing hotels train us to say, you know what? We only clean your room every 3 days.
Right.
Right. Those aren't the conditions under which wages rise faster than prices, leading to a cost, you know, a labor, you know, wage cost spiral. I just don't see it. And that could be me being wrong, right? I just want to emphasize this. Like I could be totally wrong on this. But the unique feature that I saw in the 1960s and 1970s was this fantastic outward shift in the aggregate demand curve that's just a function of population growth, labor force growth, et cetera. I just don't see it.
I would say that I've been impressed with that analysis here since I first heard you say it a while back about the 70s. I guess being a creature of that environment and, you know, coming into my initial job earning money and things, I may be overly emphasizing the things that I've emphasized because of my experience, but the psychological component to me was so powerful in that what people expected and people began to believe that prices could not come down. And I was even more impressed on the flip side, because I remember vividly, we ran equity money, but in the early 80s, we bought, you know, Tigers and Strips and all these different, yep, you know, because of their 12, 13, 14% compounders.
Of course.
But in the 83 to 84 period, when the economy started, you know, was coming back and doing well, there was such a freak out over Milton Friedman's idea. He was wrong about then. I remember seeing him speak. I went and I was so disappointed because he thought inflation was going to come roaring back. And it seemed to me like it wasn't, that it was under control. And yet the psychology was so powerful then that in 84, we saw the bond market back up to, I think, 12 or 13%. And the only thing that seemed to me that was driving that was the psychology. People didn't believe that inflation had been conquered, but yet it was going to come back. And that was enough to move the bond market that far. The bond market was obviously a little freer beast then than it is today. So I've been struck by the power of psychology from my early experience in that. And that's a bias that I have, and I could be wrong about that as well.
So one, I think it's always really hard to put on our hat from our 20s, right? And remember how we were thinking about things, because there were two separate components, right? One is your wage was rising rapidly because your experience base was rising so rapidly, right? That it's very easy to get lost in that framework, right? Like, I expected to make 20% more every year in my 1920s. Well, I expected to make 100% more every year in my 20s, right? The second component is remember what Volcker was actually doing. So that 83-84 environment, Volcker hiked interest rates by 400 basis points.
I understand that. But if collectively people were smart, you know, they could have let the curve bend backwards in the long end. I remember listening to what people were saying and the arguments at the time. Anyway, I don't want to get caught off on a side discussion of that period. And I wasn't looking at it from an income standpoint. I was looking at it from the prices of things kept going up and how it impacted me about what I thought I needed to be able to do to deal with that.
So just very quickly, right? Those underlying dynamics, when you talk about the curve flattening, inverting, et cetera, you almost saw that in 83. The curve almost inverted.
Right.
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 The second thing is, remember that the growth of the labor force associated with the baby boomers and women, et cetera, didn't like go to 3.5% in 1979 and then fall to zero.
Right. Right. Right.
Right. It continued to shift outward. And in particular, in the United States, as credit reemerged, as people were able to finance stuff, as we moved away from the 20% interest rates, that meant that demand was shifting outwards even more than it otherwise would have in the face of those low interest rates, right? So that perception of high aggregate demand continued. It's just the second derivative of it, right? The amount that it was increasing every year began to fall, right? And that's the part that I think people really struggle with, because again, like, what we're actually seeing now is we're seeing credit availability fall. We're seeing the cost of taking out mortgages and second home loan, you know, home equity loans and refinancing your mortgage and freeing up additional cash so that you can go on that vacation with your family, et cetera. That's all going away. And it's happening at the exact same time that the Federal Reserve seems absolutely intent on not only shrinking their balance sheet, right, which introduces all sorts of risks around credit spreads because of the reverse dynamic of playing through that. You know, we can go around and around and around about whether it's money printing versus supporting risk assets. But as those credit spreads widen back out, the collateral in your portfolio, your ability to tap in for excess cash, for financing, et cetera, goes away. And all that demand shrinks, right? So like, I, you know, yes, we're still seeing demand that's associated with rebuilding inventories, but I mean, you know, CPI was up 7.5% and retail sales on a year-over-year basis are up 4.3%. That's not growth.
Mike, let me ask you, if this transitory narrative holds, presumably that means you're in the bond.
Well, let's be really clear. The transitory narrative has not held, right?
Like, well, that define transitory, right? Well, exactly. I'm going to use your definition of transitory for now. But presumably that what that means is that the current spike we're seeing in yields is going to go away and will moderate and come down. Lacey certainly believes that, absent one important factor, which perhaps we'll touch on in a minute. But I remember you saying in our first conversation that the target date funds were protected from volatility through owning bonds. Now, has that changed, that dynamic changed, given what's happened in the bond market? And if so, how big a problem might that be?
Well, I just want to emphasize, right? So when you say that they are protected from that volatility, that's the tool that they use for protection.
Right.
Right. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're protected. And that's one of the reasons that this has become so confusing to people is that the traditional correlation between higher interest rates and equity prices has started to show signs of breaking, right?
Exactly.
Where the evidence is increasingly clear that the market can't sustain interest rates above a certain level. And I would focus people on things like the level of 2-year interest rates or 5-year interest rates as compared to the 30-year or the 10-year. The 10-year is largely tied to the housing market. But if I look at it from a high yield standpoint or a corporate standpoint, that 2-year rate or that 5-year rate plays a huge role in my ability to refinance, right? The 2-year rate is almost the easiest way of saying, like, am I willing to gamble, right? In the case of most of the high yield that has been put on, and this can be levered loans, it can be lower grade credits that's been put on, a lot of those companies legitimately cannot afford higher interest rates, right? And so now we're suddenly approaching a need to refinance. Again, that 18-month window between, you know, my appearances on the end game starts to matter, because that means that a 5-year duration refinancing is now only 2.5 right. years away from needing to be replaced. And they're looking at having to replace them with much higher costs. That's not tenable for a lot of the more levered companies and junkier companies that are out there. You know, can they pay back their debt? Can they do all sorts of things if they're tied to commodities? Possibly. We're definitely seeing elements of this in shale, where they'd prefer to spend the money on paying down debt levels or various other stuff if they did not already go bankrupt and be forced into a restructuring. But all the evidence is that the market is already saying that the Fed is being forced into this for political reasons. That transitory narrative has proven to be so offensive to people that the Fed is now backed into a corner where they have to do something, even as all the evidence is that the economy is slowing down significantly. And, you know, the other argument that I would point to is people in 20 and 2021, their argument was, oh, well, this makes perfect sense, because MMT forever, right? Like, we are literally around the globe watching the world's greatest austerity measures since, you know, the extreme versions in places like Greece, et cetera. But like, this is incredible what we're facing as every government around the world is suddenly competing to show how sober they are. Like, this is a massively negative fiscal impulse that's coming our way. I know the word transitory has lost, but I can't help but look at it and say, geez, this is going to get really ugly.
Mike, just define what really ugly means to you.
Well, really ugly for me takes on two different characteristics. And one of them I referred to earlier, right? What's happening in the emerging markets is actually a human catastrophe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, the great irony, of course, is that people run around using mean reversionary asset allocation to say, well, it's time for emerging markets, right? Like, man, it feels like time for emerging markets in the same way it was time for emerging markets under, you know, Allende and Perón and et cetera, right? Like, yeah, it's time for emerging markets to get really, really nuts because they are failing as countries. And that's not a judgment on the people that inhabit there or even really the politicians. It's just that their position is so unfavorable that I can't possibly imagine how we get out of this without real disaster. The second component is what happens within the developed markets. And in the United States, like, you know, I joke about this, you know, people talk about we live in the age of uncertainty, right? Like, yeah, it's starting to feel a little bit more that way. But I used to say a couple of years ago, like, that is the biggest crock of crap on the planet. We live in the age of certainty, right? How do you get to work? I take a 4,000 pound steel vehicle that has a life expectancy of 12 years, and I complain if it breaks down and I lose it, you know, 1 or 2 days of service, forgetting that my ancestors, you know, had carts pulled by furred steeds that, you know, actually got sick, right? You know, so like you needed to keep multiple of them so that you would always have a healthy horse, right? The great, you know, epizootic plague was a flu for horses in the 1870s that set off a collapse in property markets around the world because of the loss of horses. Like that's, and by the way, spurred the development of the automobile. That's why we got the horseless carriage. So we have that type of certainty that we've always treated. We get to work by driving on a concrete freeway that's maintained by the state, right? Like all these things are very different than anything we've seen before. What you're largely seeing today is just a tiny bit of uncertainty being interjected into that system. And I can't possibly know exactly how it's going to play out, but it does feel like the biggest risk is developed market governments being forced, as we're seeing with Jerome Powell today, to quote unquote, do something, you know, right? You know, don't just stand there, do something. Inflation is impossible. This is terrible. This is destroying people's lives. You have to deal with a shortage of oil by hiking interest rates. What? Like, how does that help?
I think part of the problem is that the Fed got away with a lot for a long time. I think that arguably their Fed policies benefited lots of people who have assets. And so people had confidence in them because under the Fed, they made lots of money. I don't think the level of inflation was as low as the data suggested. Obviously, it's a personal thing, depending on what you buy. Everyone's basket's different, depending on what your station in life is. And I think the Fed was extraordinarily cavalier about, well, we're not going to look forward. We're going to, you know, what their goals were for inflation. You know, they made up that they needed to get inflation up to 2%. I mean, they made up a lot of things along the way that were really, quite frankly, stupid for them to do. And now they're, you know, you behave in an irresponsible manner. Sometimes it comes back to bite you in the ass. And so now they're backed into a corner of dealing with things that were a function of, if they'd have been a little more humble along the way, a little sort of like the way some of these experts treated COVID data, they might not be in the pickle they're in right now. But a lot of times you get blamed for things that weren't exactly your fault, but it's cumulative. And I think that's part of the dynamic that we're dealing with now is that they were arrogant. They acted carelessly. They should have stopped this a year ago. I mean, why would that have been that difficult? But anyway,
but Bill,
I didn't
also,
mean to get on my soapbox there.
No, but look, also they've set themselves up and eagerly accepted this idea that they are the people you go to when you have any problems, right? And it just so happens the problems have all been in one direction for the longest time. And now everyone's standing there, well, okay, guys, we got a problem here.
Well, they always said when they were going to run off the balance sheet before Janet Yellen said, it's like watching paint dry. You know, Ben Bernanke understood the financial system so little, he said subprime was contained before it started to blow up. I can give you plenty of examples of their arrogance or their overdriving their headlights.
So I want to emphasize, though, I'm not an apologist for the Fed, right?
I wasn't trying to say that you were, Mike.
Yeah, no, and I know you're not, right? But let's remember that lots of people got 2007 wrong, right? Like Ben Bernanke is a very public figure who put his foot in his mouth and said, I believe that subprime is contained, right? Ended up being totally wrong. Chuck Prince, you know, when the music's playing, you got to dance, right? Every single person involved in that process had to do the same thing. And the incentive structures associated with it to stand up and say, oh my God, there's fire in the theater, right? Like it just doesn't exist, right? I mean, when you dealt with LPs, and we've all been there in this room, right? When you're dealing with investors, et cetera, have you ever written a letter that says, oh my God, I have no idea what's going on. My portfolio is a complete shambles. And I'm going to be, I'm trying to be really humble about this, but you probably should take all your money away. Right. Like, no, I mean, I actually did that.
I've come close.
Exactly. So this is exactly the point. I did that in June of 2008. I've told the story of the dumbest man alive, the smartest man alive. Right. And part of the reason why I tell that story is to highlight that, like, you never actually know, right? This is an industry filled with really smart people. Jerome Powell is an incredibly bright guy who I am willing to bet is trying his best. Right. Like what he's doing is not a function of arrogance or stupidity or the fact that his IQ is 94 and ours happens to be 106. Right. Like it's these are super talented, really smart people doing the best that they possibly can in an environment in which fiscal policy, Congress, which is actually supposed to set these spending priorities, has largely abdicated it in the face, in favor of sniping at each other's individual attempts to either fix things or behave badly, and meanwhile trading their way to financial success. Right now, the Fed is guilty of that as well, but the simple reality is, I don't know what they were expected to do. I was shouting to the Fed members that I know in March of 2020, you have to get money to small businesses. This is not about cutting interest rates. We have to figure out a way to provide liquidity if we're going to shut down the economy, right?
The problem is they never know how to walk back from what they do. I could argue that they start the fire and then they show up as the firemen and they get credit for putting the fire out. I agree that what you were advocating, and I remember you advocating about a lot of those things back then. My point is that collectively, they have an arrogance about their view. I'll never forget reading the Fed minutes that, of course, were released 7 years later about what they were actually discussing in the middle of the dot-com bubble. Right? Part of that was in my book. I may be too jaded on this, but based on everything I've seen, they have come to a position where they never want to do anything proactive that might be negative for the markets, when in fact they need that. Their penchant for wanting to tell you exactly what they're going to do allows people to get super levered and act crazy. So I think they have created their own problem of communication and dealing with things because they refuse to ever make tough decisions. The tough decisions they make in the moment of crisis are always to print trillions of dollars, create gobs and gobs of liquidity. So now they're getting put in a box, not entirely of their making. I started off on this tangent to try to explain why I think they're getting dumped on extra hard, but I say they collectively earned this.
Well, I think part of the irony, of course, is that the players at the table change, right? So Kaplan's no longer there, et cetera, right? So collectively deserving something, I think, is hard.
Okay. To okay.
Argue fair. For, right.
Okay. Okay.
As an institution, they might certainly, and we've seen a lot of bad behavior associated with it. And again, I want to emphasize that the core of the issue that I think that they're dealing with, right, is a system that has become far too finely tuned. And you do bring up a very, very valid point when you say they no longer want to negatively shock the markets. They saw that in 1994. You hear this referred to over and over and over again, right? Now, was 94 a right choice? Who knows?
Well, we blew up a couple guys in Orange County. The rest of the world moved on, right?
Well, we blew up Orange County, right? We also blew up Mexico and the tequila crisis.
Mexico had a hand in that themselves. I happen to have been short Mexico.
So did Orange County. So did
I know. So, I mean, listen, finance is tricky. Yeah. You act like an idiot. You get carried away because you thought it was easy.
And that's where I was going to go with it, which is, look, I still think one of the most interesting proposals. Now, I think it's unfortunately very difficult to work, right? But Stan Druckenmiller, I think it was 2 or 3 years ago, came out with the argument that said, look, the Fed should basically have a random number generator.
Yes, right? Exactly.
And instead of setting, Fed funds rate at 25%, 25 basis points, it should, based on the random output, it should hike it by 25 basis points or cut it by 25 basis points every once in a while, effectively to remove the tightness or degree of leverage and speculation that's put in there, right?
The Fed put leads to more trouble than it solves.
Yes and no, right? I mean, it's a little bit like dealing with a drug addicted teenager. Do you decide to cut them off in the middle of a true withdrawal environment, right?
Like, no, not then. But there was ample time to have not spoon fed everybody.
Right. So fortunately, my kids have not, you know, experienced any of those challenges. Unfortunately, many American families have had to deal with that sort of dynamic. And so I just want to emphasize that part of what also happens is that you become so exhausted putting out the immediate fire that when the opportunity comes to say, you know what, it seems like things are working and people are screaming at you, you got to do something, like, oh, man, can I just enjoy my bourbon tonight? Right. Yeah. You know, like,
but they have their hands on very powerful levers. And so we ought to ask more of them than
that is a very different statement. And again, it goes back to this Stan Druckenmiller dynamic. What we need to do is go back to a world in which we didn't even know who the Fed chairperson was or who they were, you know, who the governors were. And if James Bullard stood up and talked, you'd be like, wow, who's that curly haired, you know, slightly older guy who seems to repeat whatever the last person said to him, right?
Well, there's a proposal I think all three of us can agree on wholeheartedly.
Right. And so this is part of the challenge, right, is that what we actually need to do is we need to remove the degree of financial accommodation. We need to reduce the role of the Fed. There are some incredibly thoughtful and smart proposals from guys like Richard Werner in terms of the reemergence of community banking, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Like those things ultimately are correct and right and very, very important. I have full props to the crypto community for their frustration and anger at the system as it's set up today and their search for an alternative. Now, the fact that search for the alternative is taken on religious overtones that leads them down a very catastrophic path in my mind. Like that, you know, that's unrelated to the complaints, but what they're doing is functionally the same thing that we're doing where we bitch and complain about the Fed and there's nothing we can actually do about it either. And so again, you know, there was a terrible Twitter exchange where somebody reached out to me in response to Canada and said, you know, hey, Mike, what should us plebs do, you know, to protect ourselves against the depredations of our government? And my response was, there's nothing you can do. Right? There's nothing you can do. We are too small. We are ants playing in, you know, a giant system in which some people have been given too much authority, too much power, and we still have the opportunity. This goes back to the tail end of our conversation in the end game. We may still have windows of opportunity for us to vote the bums out, replace them with people who are thoughtful. But good Lord, we're doing it. You know, we're doing a terrible job. Forget what the Fed is doing. Yeah. Look who we're putting in charge.
Well, that's a very valid point, right?
But look at the selection pool. I mean, that's another problem,
right? Because our national pastime is doxing somebody.
Right. Yeah, cancel culture has been a. Grant and I were talking this before you came on about in our business, we're wrong all the time. And if you get to any level of success, you know you can be wrong and you learn to admit it. And that's, you know, that makes life easier because you can take that pressure off yourself. But these politicians, that people have never been in our business, have never been confronted with that. And they're unwilling to say, you know, I screwed that up. I should have done this. I don't think they realize they'd have way more credibility if they just admitted that, you know, we're human. We got it wrong.
I'm going to push back on that because in the political realm, many places around the world, and unfortunately, increasingly true in the United States, making an admission like that as a politician opens you up to civil and criminal lawsuits that would be extraordinary, right? So if, it, you know, take the extreme example. If, oh my God, why am I blanking on the name of the former governor of New York?
Cuomo.
Right? If Cuomo decided to come out and say, you know what, mea culpa, it was my fault. I shouldn't have sent people into nursing homes and I certainly shouldn't have covered it up. Like, what is the next thing that happens to him?
Okay. I guess what I meant more was when there was this certainty, what people thought about what all the data was going to lead to vis-a-vis COVID. Why can't the CDC say, you know, we made these decisions, the data subsequently has looked like this, and therefore, we think the policy should be this. Next time around, we might not do that. You know, that's more what I'm talking about. They might have some credibility. I mean, I think they've done it. The CDC and these government agencies, even the FDA, I've lost a tremendous amount of respect for them because of how they tried to bullshit us on so many topics.
100%. And so we've seen that sort of responsibility taking from the Roman Catholic Church. We've seen the Episcopalian Church step forward. I'm joking. Nobody does that. Right. I mean, the guys who run Melvin Capital.
Well, I think it was a huge flaw for the Catholic Church. I mean, I think they've handled this as bad.
Of course it was. But you're in a catch 22 in a litigious society. Do you stand up and say, yeah, it was my fault? Right.
Hold no, but
that's, you know, like that's the last ask any defense attorney. Do you ever admit responsibility? No.
Right. But responsibility is one thing. Admitting that you need to change course because circumstances have changed.
So again, this is the importance of the humility that Bill is referring to, right?
Yeah, exactly.
At some point, the Federal Reserve should be saying something along the lines of, you have to understand we have limited ability to do anything about this problem.
Right.
Right?
There you go.
That, by the way, would be a really important thing and very powerful. And I agree with you that it would probably start the process of healing. The problem is if Jerome Powell says that, Joe Biden fires him and replaces him with some huckster who says, I know the solution.
Well, he can't exactly fire him though. Assume if he gets nominated because he's got the, you know.
You can make life so unhappy.
Biden could? Oh, God, he couldn't make anybody's life. Anyway.
If Lyndon Johnson could pick up William McChesney Martin and throw him against the wall, I'm fairly
certain. That was a different time in a different place. Anyway, we can choose to disagree about that, Mike. I
don't even think we're disagreeing about it. But the point is that if Joe Biden or Kamala Harris were to suddenly start referring to Jerome Powell as, you know, that gross old white guy who likes to touch people in inappropriate fashion, my guess is he'd quit his job pretty soon.
Okay, you're saying they could cancel him, basically.
Of course.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Sadly, that's easy. Well, listen, Mike, it's been a fantastic time. I've just realized how long we've been going. If it came down to it, I'd put my money on the 6'4", 250 Mike Green pinning the Fleckenstein up against the wall. But hopefully it doesn't.
Yeah,
it doesn't
come pretty down sure to that. That'd be the outcome.
Fortunately, I'm well below 250 now. So, but I listen, guys. This, as always, is great.
Not at all. But before you go, just remind people where they can follow you on Twitter. I know you gave it out earlier on, but let's put it all in one place for them to make it easy.
Sure. So, my Twitter, confusingly, is at profplum99, PROFPLUM99. My firm is Simplify Asset Management. We offer ETFs that are available through brokerage firms and registered investment advisors. And you can find us at www.simplify.us. Grant referred earlier to our podcast. We do a firm-wide podcast once a month called Keeping It Simple. And we try to bring on guests that are 10 times more intelligent than the ones Grant brings on. Those are the easiest ways of finding out what we're doing and what we're thinking about. And if you've stuck through this, you seem to be weirdly interested in what I'm thinking about. I can't imagine why, but thank you very much. I appreciate it.
And your podcasts on Simplify are excellent. I'll state that for the record.
I really appreciate that, Bill.
Mike, always a pleasure, mate. Take care of yourself and we'll see you soon.
Okay. Take care, Grant. Bye,
thanks,
Bill.
Man.
Bye, Mike. Wow, that might be the longest podcast we've done.
Yeah, I could see you. I was as engrossed as you. I just looked up the time and thought, holy Jesus.
I know, it's like, I decided, let's just have this go where it goes. It's always fun to get Mike because you can talk about lots of things that are really interesting. But just to let the conversation evolve and see where it goes.
And Mike, as you say, Mike's the perfect guy for that, right, Mike? Mike's just... He's just such a great brain and such a great guy, and it's always interesting to have that opportunity, knowing that he's going to push back on stuff and he's going to kick in with stuff, which is exactly what you want, right? I mean, that's the whole point of doing this stuff. I mean, and to have that conversation go in so many different directions, I think was great, not just for us, but hopefully for the audience too.
Well, I think a lot of people will find that there will be products that are offered at Simplify that are tick a box that people would like to have ticked that they didn't know was available and they couldn't do themselves. I mean, I think what they're doing there is, you know, if that was a public stock, if Simplify was a public stock, I would buy it.
Yeah, no, I think the same way. And I think anytime you get guys like Mike and you throw in Harley and you get that kind of brain power behind something, it's just a good thing to be involved with. Well, mate, we're back. And what a great way to come back. That was a fantastic conversation. Thanks to our guest, Mike Green, for doing such a wonderful job, as he always does. Once again, you'll find him on Twitter at ProfPlum99 and Simplify.us is the website. I would recommend you go and check out the stuff. And as we said, the podcasts they do are well worth your time also.
Mm-hmm. They're very nice. They're very good.
Yeah, really are. That's it from us for another episode of The Endgame. We'll be back again soon. In the meantime, you can follow me on Twitter, should you wish to do so. You'll find me at TTMYGH.
And I'm still at FleckCap.
He's still at FleckCap. All right, matey, I will see you soon. Take care.
All righty, great.
Nothing we discussed during The Endgame should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So, while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets.